Good morning, Mr. Farrey.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Let me turn on your mic. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. There you are. So the DUP brought me in chocolate. Mike Nesbitt brought me in a lemon. You've brought me in.
Well, I heard a
nothing.
Lemon.
Diddly squat.
The lemon didn't was too bitter. We brought you a very weighty manifesto. That's what we've brought you.
Yes. And isn't that the truth? It's, what is it, 80-odd pages long?
It is. And it's detailed for a very good reason. But it's also shorter than it was in 2011, where we had over 140 pages.
Size isn't everything, Stephen. You say there's been a failure of leadership over crucial issues in your manifesto. You're critical. You say progress has been held up by bickering and political gridlock. Stormont needs a transformation, you say. Not a telly show last night. I was reading this after that. And I thought, have they lost the plot? You were part of this Stormont executive for years. Part of the system you're slagging off.
We were, and we have a very strong record of delivery in that
regard.
So
you're slagging yourselves off.
No, but let me put this in context. Northern Ireland is definitely a better place today than it was 18 years ago. So particularly for the generation of the Good Friday Agreement, life has improved significantly. Opportunities are better. Indeed, Stormont itself has not been a complete failure. There has been achievements. The executive has engaged in a whole range of issues, in particular the two departments controlled by Alliance.
It's all of your manifesto negativity. Failure, yes. You say. Political gridlock. Needs a transformation. Well, you were part of it.
We were, and we have a record. And within the manifesto, you'll see that there are sections set out our particular achievements in our two departments and also what our other MLAs have achieved as part of the Assembly as well. The point we're making there is that we have delivered, we have a track record before us, and if you can go back as far as the 2011 manifesto and actually judge what we said back then and actually then look at our record over the past 5 years, you'll see that the two coincide very strongly. So we have a track record of delivery, and indeed some others have delivered as well. I'm not trying to just sort of say it's only Alliance that's actually done anything over the past 5 years, but at the same time the progress has not been fast enough as in terms of what people should have the right to expect. There's a whole range of opportunities that have been missed, and we have a range of issues where we have seen deadlock over the past number of years, and issues that have been simply neglected because they've been too difficult in terms of our political system. So we have to get the grasp of those. But we can't simply leave them on the shelf.
Well, can you have it both ways, Stephen? Can you gurn and whinge about the bigger parties and then hold their coats?
Well, that's not what we're seeking to do. We're seeking to transform Northern Ireland society. I'm not here. I'm not in politics as some sort of sport where we score points off one another for some form of entertainment. I'm in politics to make a difference. Whenever I can make a difference, I'm extremely pleased by that. Whenever I can't make a difference and my colleagues are in the same position, whenever we can't make a difference, we're hugely frustrated. And that frustration reflects what we're hearing from a host of people across Northern Ireland, where there are important issues to them, critical reforms that aren't being made that are holding our society back, and people do want to see the pace of change in Northern Ireland accelerating significantly over the next 5 years. We have done some things, but the entry for Stormont is still massive.
What have you delivered for Northern Ireland? What's your party delivered?
Well, in terms of my own particular department, we have transformed the skills landscape in Northern Ireland, and we have seen major changes in terms of people's ability to engage with the labour market.
What you've delivered to students in Northern Ireland, or what you are going to deliver in the future, is the prospect of student fees gone up?
No, we haven't said that there's a prospect of student fees going up.
Because you told me that.
There are a range of different options and different scenarios that are available to us. Now,
you did a consultation on it as minister, didn't you?
We did indeed. We did the consultation.
So you're delivering the prospect, the possibility of student fees. Well,
let me explain what we have done. We have a situation in Northern Ireland where back in 2011, the executive quite rightly took a decision to freeze tuition fees in Northern Ireland in line with inflation. Since then, there's been an obligation on the executive to fill the funding gap that results from that decision. We did it in 2011, but that situation has deteriorated over the past number of years, and we've seen even bigger cuts in more recent times. So our current financial model for higher education is not sustainable. But if we look around the world, if we're looking closer to home, we see there's a range of different models. In England, they have fees of £9,000. In Scotland, there's zero fees for local
students.
So
what are you going to deliver? You heard me. I don't know. Did you see the telly programme?
I saw bits of it.
Okay.
I was busy electioneering, Stephen.
Naomi Long was on with us.
Yes. And she did very well, I gather.
Well, she was saying under your party, under your watch, student fees might go up. So that's not a red line.
The starting point.
No guarantee for students. No promises for them. Nothing they can buy in to, because student fees might go up. What to, Stephen? $9,000, like elsewhere?
The starting point for Alliance is to recognise that we have to have a sustainable higher education system in terms of its finances, and one that delivers for the local economy.
And if that needs extra money, might you recommend student fees going up?
What our preference and what we said are saying very clearly in the manifesto is we believe under devolution we have the ability to keep the hybrid model of a low fee in Northern Ireland with state support. However, what is required, what is missing, is that the executive needs to invest to ensure that we address the funding
gap.
But
if the other parties, Stephen, say no, we've got other priorities. Are you going to walk? Are you going to stay in there and watch student fees going up?
Well, I don't see any pressure coming for an increase in student fees in Northern Ireland. Now, clearly we have a funding gap. But
you've been highlighting.
Absolutely, and I will continue to highlight. But we can go in a range of different directions in terms of how we address
that. The executive as a whole has let that gap develop and widen.
Yes.
That's the executive that you're part of.
Yes.
Which is why I'm trying to drill in this morning, and I've been doing it last night and other days too. Is there any political party in Northern Ireland that is saying, do you know what, this is such a priority for us? No. It's not a maybe, it's not a preference. We're going to fight against it. We will not be part of an executive that increases student fees in Northern Ireland. Can you say that?
Well, what we're saying is that we are very clearly identifying that there is a funding gap in higher education that must be addressed. And in particular, as we look ahead to a lower rate of corporation tax, this is an inescapable requirement if we want to transform our economy.
Is it possible? Answer this question.
Well, let me just finish up that point, Stephen. In the manifesto, we're making a very clear commitment that we want to spend an additional £85 million per year on skills in Northern Ireland. That includes addressing that funding gap. So in the manifesto, we're making a very clear policy commitment that we want to spend that additional money on skills, and that includes addressing the funding gap. And that would allow us to maintain the current approach to tuition fees.
But here's
your problem. Not lowering them in some sort of populist way, but equally being realistic.
Here's your problem in what you've just said. If it was, and if it is, a very clear commitment, in other words, promise to the people listening to this programme this morning, then you would be able to say it is a red line. You would be able to say we guarantee student fees will not go up or we will not be in there because it's a commitment to that spend.
See, I'm not going down the line today of saying what are going to be red lines or what
you've already
what
done it.
Are not
you've,
red lines.
You've used the word commitment.
Yes.
Commitment is a promise to people listening to this.
Yes.
So if you're committing to them and you don't get what you've committed to them, you would have to walk as a point of principle, wouldn't you?
I don't see that. I don't believe there's any prospect of tuition fees going up in Northern Ireland. I believe there's a political consensus, at the very least, in terms of continuing with the current approach
that
we have.
What I'm asking
some
is,
people
are
playing politics and trying to reduce fees.
Well, are you playing politics and making a commitment, but then giving yourself a get-out clause that it's not a commitment?
But
is it a commitment?
It is something that we want to see happen.
Is it a commitment?
It is something we will be arguing for at the executive table.
Is it a commitment?
It is something we will be pushing extremely hard.
You've used the word commitment.
Yeah, okay, then it's a commitment, Stephen.
Right.
But in that context...
So that's a red line, isn't it?
No,
that's a promise.
But I'm not saying what... We're not going to get into the language of red lines and not red lines, because there has to be a negotiation around a programme for government. But what I'm saying, if you look around the issues that have to be priorities for Northern Ireland... No, we're getting into a situation where we're trying to put down preconditions and not preconditions around the creation of the executive.
Don't make commitments when you do not mean it, sir.
What we mean is that we want to ensure we transform our economy. There is an inescapable requirement to invest in skills. Right across the spectrum in terms of stakeholders, including the business community, people recognise that the only way we're going to address productivity in Northern Ireland, the only way we're going to ensure we have the pipeline of people coming through for all the companies that will want to invest in Northern Ireland is through a strong pool of graduates and the high-level apprenticeships coming through. So from our point of view, this is an absolute priority for an executive.
Absolute priority that isn't a red line. And doesn't sound like an absolute commitment.
But Stephen, you're suggesting this is going to be some difficult uphill struggle. This is an open door. This is the most logical thing for an incoming executive to be doing.
You see, I guess here's how I look upon my job. I look upon my job as to try to get absolute clarity for people ahead of an election so that they know what they're definitely voting for, and so that they know where politicians are giving themselves wriggle room. So actually they might vote for that party and they might never get what they expect out of that party, because the party are able to say after an election, well, we said we would have liked to do it, but actually, nah, we've changed our mind. Or we said we would look at doing it, but now we're looking elsewhere. We said we might do it on a Monday, but today's Tuesday. The wriggle room is what I'm trying to expose in these interviews so that people know what they are voting for, all right? And it seems the more this election goes on, the less certainty we get from many parties, because voters don't need to know what will happen. It's all been left to negotiations after the election, isn't it? That's essentially what you're all saying. Every one of you are saying, that's our priority, that's this, that's that. But we're going to negotiate. We're not giving you a red line, Stephen.
Why not? See, part of the difficulty, Stephen, here is none of the political parties are running to be the government by themselves. They're running to be part of a coalition and to make judgments as to whether they will be part of that coalition. Now, in terms of what we said in our manifesto, it gives an indication of what our priorities will be across the executive, across the assembly. But it also shows that if we have the privilege of being in control of any particular department, what our priorities will be in that regard. And if you're in any doubt about our integrity around these
you
issues...
You were in control of higher education, yes, and yes, the gap still widened.
Yes. And that is due to the fact
that... So you didn't have control.
Let me answer that in two parts, Stephen. First of all, go back to what we said in 2011. I'll invite your listeners to do the same. The manifesto in 2011 is still on our website. It wasn't some sort of glossy to get us over an election campaign. It's been there as a living, breathing document over the past 5 years, which we have attempted to implement where we've had the opportunity to do so. So I invite people to compare what we said in 2011 with what we've said today in 2016 around our track record of delivery. The second point is that we have delivered in terms of reforms around the whole range of policies and programmes around skills. Where we've had difficulties is the fact that we've had a financial meltdown in terms of our public finances over the past 5 years, including a lot of reckless commitments being made by other parties, poor decisions around public spending, the fact that we had this major crisis over welfare and we ended up bleeding money out of our executive. So cuts have been passed on to departments. The process around how those cuts have been distributed has been very badly flawed. But in terms of how I have addressed the issue, I have sought to be as strategic as possible in terms of how I have managed that situation.
Is there anything in the 88 pages of this manifesto which is a red line commitment? Is there anything in the 88 pages which you will promise the public you will deliver or you'll walk out of that executive?
We have set out what is a very clear sense of direction. We've explained our values, we've explained our preferences.
That's not the question.
You're asking me, Stephen, to go down the line of saying what's a red line and what's,
I'm asking
and
you
what,
the question.
And what's not a red line.
And the possibility here is,
yes,
is the answer is no.
Yes.
Is there anything in the 88 pages of your manifesto which is a guarantee to the public or you will walk out of the executive?
The point, Stephen, you're well aware of this. People going into negotiations don't publicly declare what their red lines are. That is a process of actually negotiating yourself into a corner in terms of your ability to deliver the best in terms of what you have to offer in terms of your values and
so
your policies.
So how do people know what they're voting for?
Because what is set out in terms of our election literature going around all the doors in Northern Ireland, what's set in our manifesto is where we want to go in terms of these issues.
And no, where you want to go?
Yes,
but every single page of that 88 page might be thrown out the window because you might compromise on everything, right?
Where we will
you
go.
Might water down everything.
But the point, Stephen, if you are sceptical about what I'm saying, I repeat the point. Look at what we said we wanted to do in 2011 and in particular look at what we have done in terms of the departments where we've had direct responsibility, and you will see that we have faithfully delivered what we set out and what we promised to do to the people of Northern Ireland back in 2011. A manifesto is what you're seeking to deliver where you get the opportunity to do so. Sometimes we don't always get that opportunity. So everything in the manifesto is actually a commitment. But the commitment in the manifesto...
You sure you want to use the word commitment again?
Everything in the manifesto is a commitment.
That you might throw out the window when you go into a negotiation.
No. What I'm saying, Stephen, everything in the manifesto is a commitment. But the point I want to stress...
A commitment or a bargaining chip in a negotiation?
It is a commitment. Everything in that manifesto is something that we want to deliver if the opportunity presents itself to deliver
it. Well, there's the if. The complete ridicules the word commitment. It's not a commitment.
Well,
a commitment is I promise to do something, full stop. A commitment is not, I promise to do it if every other party in the executive who we need to get across the line gets across the line. That ain't a commitment because you've got a choice.
Yes.
If it was a commitment to the public, you would say, sorry, we have made a commitment to the public. We're not staying in this executive because we made a commitment. We're walking. I repeat the question. Is there anything in those 88 pages, it's a long manifesto, that actually is a red line commitment?
Everything in that manifesto is something that we want to deliver. But obviously, delivery of what is in the manifesto is subject to a number of factors. First of all, it's subject to how many seats we actually achieve as a party. It is subject to whether we make a judgment call as to whether we should be on the executive or not. It's subject to what departments end up in our direct control as a party, as opposed to other political parties.
Let's look at some...
It's subject to what is available in terms of public finances.
Okay.
No doubt we'll come on in the moment to talk about the public finances of Northern Ireland and where the opportunities exist and they don't exist for change.
Let's look at some of the things that you say in your manifesto you will do. We will let the public know who donates money to Northern Ireland's political parties. When did you get the power to do that?
Well, we voluntarily do it. We publish donations in line with the threshold.
Parties, plural?
Yes.
Well, so when did you get the power to force other political parties to reveal their donations?
Well, Naomi Long put legislation through Westminster, which was accepted by the Northern Ireland Office after some reluctance. The donations will be published in due course. So any donations that are now made to political parties will in time be made public.
When?
We want that to happen straight away. Frankly,
you will let the public know who donates money.
Yes, but manifestos are framed. This is how manifestos are framed. I mean, this is the language you put into manifesto. That is what we would do if we have the ability. If we what we're going to be arguing for is full transparency in terms of donations over the particular threshold.
But you don't have the power to do it, do you?
Well, that is what we want to see happen. So we are going to use our influence to those particular outcomes. So manifestos are framed in that sense. That is what we want to achieve.
Yeah.
But bear in mind that we have already achieved through what Naomi has done in Westminster that donations made to political parties in Northern Ireland will be made public in due course, whenever the Secretary of State deems it safe to do so.
So the Secretary of State decides, your party.
But that point will come soon. However, let me qualify that further by saying we do not currently believe that there's any good reason why donations should not be fully public in Northern Ireland today.
Okay.
People are hiding behind the issue of the perceived threat that would come from knowledge of who's funding political parties. We believe that is a dubious argument to be making, and we should have the full transparency in that regard at this point today.
If you did have the power, here's what you would be arguing for in Northern Ireland. Vote Alliance, and we'll bring in water charges, and we'll charge you for your prescriptions.
Well, let me separate those two issues out, okay?
So you're the party that's going to implement extra charges on people in this country in terms of their water.
Okay, Stephen, let me say I very much want to have a discussion with you around public finance. I think it's incredibly important that we talk through the situation that currently faces Northern Ireland. There are major financial pressures that are looming over the next five years, and we need to see how we're going to navigate through that. Our block grant is not going to rise in line with inflation, so de facto there's going to be a cut in terms of the available money, the money available to the executive. I'm going to come to water charges in a moment. We don't regard water charges as being a revenue raising option at this stage, and I'm going to explain that to you in proper detail in a moment. But let me first of all address the issue of prescription charges. As we look at our current health service, is currently not sustainable. The model is broken. We can't simply have a situation where we're pouring more and more money into the health service, trying to keep up with rising demand. At present, healthcare inflation is rising at about 5-6%. What I mean by that is that if you look at the issue around demand, and based upon the current configuration of the health service, in order to meet that demand, Northern Ireland's executive needs to be spending an additional 5-6% every year over the next 5 years.
I get that because some of the extra costs, as well as the cost of drugs, which goes up.
Yes,
more expensive
treatments. We have to invest in technology. That is an ongoing pressure. At the same time, the current configuration isn't working. We have waiting lists. We have problems about people getting easy access to their GP. You're well aware of all those issues. We don't have access to the same range of drugs that we have in GB. It's something like 30 drugs that aren't available in Northern Ireland. So we need to have a process of reform in terms of our health service in order to have a more sustainable model. At the same time, we also need to see, if, are the things we can do on the margins that will be of assistance? Now, prescription charges, we believe, is something that we do need to re-examine, and we are committed to introduction of a modest prescription charge for those who can't afford it.
OK, how much?
It would probably be, we're probably talking in the region of £3 to £5. I mean, this is something that will be bottomed out as part of a public consultation, but something in that region.
And how much would that you raise through that?
We would anticipate that, not least given the exemptions for people who are elderly, those for children, pregnant mothers, those in benefits, you're probably looking in the region of around £8 to £10 million per year.
Which would it cost to administer?
It'll probably cost £7 million to administer. Now, you're going to say to me, that's not a huge amount of money. I would say to you 2 points. First of all, money, £6-7 million, if that is what it is in terms of net proceedings, will make a significant difference in terms of outcomes. Every penny helps in terms of the health service. There's also a second reason for doing this.
So you've costed this properly. It would cost £3 million to administer the assessment of people, so that because what you're essentially doing is means testing people. And that's been costed by who?
Well, I'm not giving you a precise figure in that regard, but I am recognising.
I'm not looking for the figure down to the last pound, but you are giving figures this morning of 10 million revenue, 3 million costs. Who has done that?
I'm recognising that that there will be some degree of administration costs.
No, you've
cost.
Given figures I'm, this I'm, morning. Who's
I'm,
done that?
I'm giving my estimate, my sense of
your
what.
Your guess?
My estimate, my assessment.
Where did you get the estimate from?
Well, in terms of what I've seen from coming out from the Department of Health, in terms of what could well be the proceeds coming from this.
So the Department of Health have published a figure, and we can find that, can we?
Well, the Department of Health...
That there would be 10 million of revenue from prescription charges, minus the, obviously, exempting the people who've left out. We will be able to find will we?
I suspect, Stephen, that you're going to struggle to do that because...
I've
had the privilege of access to what are internal government papers.
So the documents exist, is that correct?
Well, one of the previous health ministers did try to get a consultation agreed by the Stormont executive around prescription charges, but that did not find consensus.
So the question is, there is a document that exists that says revenue from prescription charges would be 10 million. Is that correct?
I'm not in the position to give you the precise figures that were mentioned in those documents. No, Steve, that's not what I've done. What I've said is that from having looked at the issue and spoken to people, that's my assessment as to where the finances lie in this. So I want to be very clear in that regard. But the other point I was trying to stress to you in terms of the finances around this is also about helping our GP service, which is under huge pressure at present. GPs, more and more has been asked of our GPs. Yeah. We need more GPs in Northern Ireland. The Royal College of GPs is pushing for an additional 400
places. I want to come back to this. When you'd be charging people in this country for prescription charges, you would be leaving out all children in this country. Mm-hmm. You'd be leaving out all senior citizens. Mm-hmm. You'd be leaving out pregnant women. You'd be leaving out anybody who is on a long-term or chronic condition. You'd also, you've said this morning, well, there we go, people in receipt of benefits, they'd be left out too. I think I mentioned that. Are you sure there's 10 million in revenue for the people who are left?
Yeah, and to be straight with you, Stephen, those exemptions may well cover about 80% of prescriptions that are issued. So we are talking about the revenue being raised from about 20%. Okay. But there are people like myself who are on reasonable salaries who can't afford to pay for their prescriptions. Okay. And we should be making that contribution.
All right, let's move on.
Let me just explain the point around the GPs, because we have a situation at present where GPs are handling a massive amount of cases. I mean, they're the first entry point in terms of the health service. And one of the benefits of having a prescription charge is that you better control the number of cases that are being referred to GPs, because people sometimes go to GPs just to get a script in order to go to get essentially drugs free.
Okay.
And that will help to ease the pressure in that regard.
One of the other things, as I mentioned, that Alliance, if you had the power to do so, would bring to this country, well, let's call it a commitment, to use your words, you're committing to imposing water charges on everyone in Northern Ireland.
Okay, let me be very clear on this, Stephen. I do want to give you a detailed answer in this regard. In terms of how we're looking to address the public finances in Northern Ireland, so there are three different elements that we are looking at. One is how we address the cost of division, where we're managing duplication, the different on costs in terms of how we interact, the waste that currently exists, and then revenue raising measures. The things that we do count as revenue raising measures, including prescription charges, what we do in terms of the regional rate. In terms of water, we are not classifying what we want to do around water charges as a revenue-raising measure. If you look at our manifesto...
If it's not revenue-raising, why are you doing it?
I will explain it, that to you. It's a very, very important reason why this should happen. If you look at our manifesto, the issue of water charges appears in the section on infrastructure, not on finance. It doesn't sit alongside the revenue-raising measures that we have outlined. But there are three important reasons why we should be considering a water charge. The money that we would raise from a water charge, we would offset from the regional rate. So what we are talking about is moving money that we currently raise from the regional rate and instead raising the equivalent amount of money, the same amount of money households wouldn't be paying any more in net terms from a water charge.
But I read your manifesto. You also support a rise in the regional rate?
We do.
One minute you're telling us you're offsetting.
Yes.
Regional
rates,
but you're also committing to putting our rates up as well.
Then you could also have a modest increase in the regional rate, which would also then bring more money in actual net terms to the executive. And that's important that we do seek to raise
revenue. Stick with water charges.
Absolutely, let's stick with water charges. There's three reasons why it's important that we would have that we would channel that money. The basic answer is that we get a bigger bang for our buck if we raise that pound through a water charge than if we raise that pound through the regional rate. And three reasons. First of all, in terms of compliance with the European Union Water Directive, that we may have to have a standing charge in Northern Ireland for water, so that may be something that is inescapable for us.
Sorry, hold on. We may.
We may.
Every time a politician says may, there's a little just ting goes off in my body.
I get
prickly heat every time Stephen, a politician says may. Does the European Union require us to implement water charges?
Under the EU Water Directive, yes, but countries can have derogations from that.
And it remains
to be seen how sustainable the current approach is going to be in that regard. And if you look to what's happening in the Republic of Ireland, you'll see that debate being played out.
How much?
The second issue is in terms of VAT treatment. At present, in the main, water charges are VAT exempt. Under the current situation where the executive subsidises Northern Ireland water, there is a risk that we could be hit with a significant VAT bill in terms of the tens of millions.
How come we haven't been hit with it already?
Well, it's an issue in terms of, I'm saying it's a risk in terms of interpretation, but it's not something that's happened at this stage, but it is a risk. Those are two, shall we say, slightly smaller reasons than the third reason we're coming to, which is around the nature of Northern Ireland water itself. You're aware we've had significant flooding in Northern Ireland in mm-hmm. recent years, the so-called one in a 100-year events are happening almost every year. There are issues around the sustainability of our water and sewage infrastructure.
Okay.
So Northern Ireland Water needs to be investing significant amounts of capital.
I hear that.
Let me explain the reason here.
You've had a long time in this.
I know, but it's a very, very important question.
Well, there's a better question coming up soon.
Right. Now, the point I'm making here is that whenever Northern Ireland Water is funded through a subsidy from the executive, they do not have the ability to go out to borrow money commercially on good terms to ensure that we have a proper fund for capital investment in their infrastructure. If they have an income that's coming into them through a charge as opposed to money coming in terms of a subsidy from the executive, they can go to commercial banks with a longer term revenue stream, which allows them to borrow more money, and through that means we can then invest more in our infrastructure.
Okay, and that's a lot of detail, and you have clearly thought it through as a political party. For those people listening who don't care, and by the way, quite a few people will care about the detail that you presented there.